Okay, we call the next case, Debbie Conchua versus Home Depot, and we hear first from Mr. Colum. Mr. Colum is appearing by telephone today because he got his schedule mixed up and he thought the hearing was tomorrow. Is that right, Mr. Colum?
Yes, Your Honor, and I want to start by apologizing to the court and to opposing counsel for the...
Well, you know, you didn't really ask for oral argument, but you would think after we decided we needed it that you'd want to come over and be on your A game.
Hopefully I can make up for it during over the phone.
All right, well, go ahead.
During the first 12 years of Debbie Cotswold's employment with Home Depot, she only received positive employment reviews and steadily advanced in the company. Suddenly, in less than 5 months, she went from a valuable employee to one who needed to be fired. When the correct legal standards are applied to this case, the question of whether what happened in those 5 months was age discrimination, gender discrimination, or retaliation must be decided by a jury. Your Honors, we believe there are three reasons why this court must reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment to Home Depot and allow a jury to determine the weight and credibility of Ms. Cotswold's Title VII claims. First, the district court relied on an incorrect legal standard to grant Home Depot summary judgment on Ms. Cotswold's age and gender discrimination claims. Second, the district court did not correctly consider the facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Cotswold to determine whether there was a genuine issue a material fact for trial. Third, to grant summary judgment on Ms. Cotswold's claim would mean that employers could easily hide unlawful discrimination and avoid Title VII liability. But before I support these arguments, would the court like a brief recitation of the facts?
Sorry, can you say your third one? Employers could easily do something, and I couldn't hear you.
I apologize, Your Honor. Could easily hide unlawful discrimination and avoid liability under Title VII.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Colum, as I see it, the issue in this case is pretext. The employer terminated your client for bad performance, and then the defendant came back with a rebuttal to that, and the question is whether there's a question of fact on pretext. Now, do you agree?
I do agree with that, Your Honor. And the issue, one of the first issues along that line, is that the district court applied the wrong legal standard in determining whether we could survive summary judgment on pretext. He applied the pretext plus standard from St. Mary's Honor Center versus Hicks, but of course that was reversed by the Supreme Court in Reed versus Sanderson Plumbing Products Incorporated, where the Supreme Court said that to show pretext, all the plaintiff had to do was show that the employer's alleged legitimate non-discriminatory reason was unworthy of credence. We did not also have to show that the real reason was unlawful discrimination. The court said that if the employer's reason, if the stated reason is not worthy of credibility, that in itself is enough for the jury to define unlawful discrimination.
But as part of the prima facie case, you still have to have some evidence of discrimination, don't you, even before we get there? So there has to be some evidence of discrimination in the record. It can't just be their pretext is false. There has to be something there from which the jury could infer in discrimination, right?
Yeah, Your Honor, it's true that the prima facie case requires certain elements to be proven, and the district court even found that we could meet those elements for age and gender discrimination. And I don't believe Home Depot continues to contest that we can't. But beyond that, we do have evidence of age and gender discrimination. One of the employees that worked under Ms. Cotswold provided evidence that the supervisor, the district manager that basically was the one that recommended termination, belittled females, treated female employees and managers differently than male employees. There's a bunch of evidence in the record to support that. The real question is, do we have to have, does Home Depot have to have some explicit evidence that they terminated Ms. Cotswold for age and gender discrimination? Well, of course, the courts realized a long time ago that employers particularly employers as big as Home Depot, are going to be too savvy to admit that their reasons for termination are discriminatory. They're going to hide it. And so if you look at this case, it's not only the assistant store manager who provided evidence that there was discriminatory motives, but you have to look at the circumstances of the termination. The fact that she was a long-time employee, the fact that she had been store manager for a significant period of time, the fact that the person who decided that she needed to be terminated had previously given her, you know, mostly positive employment reviews, and then all of a sudden, in a five-month period, there becomes, you know, July there's a disciplinary notice. August, there's a disciplinary notice. October, there's a disciplinary notice. November, there's a disciplinary notice. December, she's fired. It's just the circumstances of that are questionable in itself. And then if you
She admits most of the complaints that were contained in those disciplinary notices. It's hard for me to see how you can really argue that her performance was not terrible, really.
Well, I would have to disagree with Your Honor's view that
tell
she
me,
admit
most. Tell me why. I mean, she admitted that she allowed an employee to use her apartment, creating an appearance of favoritism. She delayed in making price changes and delay in pack downs. She admitted she didn't complete all the calls to the five biggest customers as required. They had a 75% off sale on lighting, which she didn't put the notices up. Failure to secure a light rack after being ordered to do so, allowing merchandise on the backside of the store to deteriorate. I mean, she admitted all those.
Smoking the cigarette in the apron, Home Depot apron.
Right. So why isn't that grounds for termination?
Well, let me unpack that generally and then respond to the specific comments. I think, first of all, there's a whole bunch of other allegations in those complaints that she denies. And so to pick a few of those and say, well, she admitted this, to ignore all the stuff she denies, I think it's unfair to her. In fact, if you view the evidence in the light most favorable to my client as required, I think the fact that she admits that is a plus for her. It means that she's an honest employee. And when she denies the other allegations, that should be given more weight. But if you go through the actual specific things that she admits, like she allowed an employee to use her apartment, well, if you look at the rules for Home Depot, there's actually no rule against that. I mean, if you actually look at the specific regulation that they pointed to, it only applied to hourly employees. The employees she allowed to stay at the apartment were salaried employees. So specifically, it didn't apply. And she didn't agree that that was a sign of favoritism. She agreed. She said that she did it, but it was the reason she allowed the salaried employees is because she knew that they stayed an hour away from the store. And she didn't want them to have to close at night and have to drive really late at night. So, I mean, so that's one of the responses.
Hold on, let me ask you this. On those written complaints, didn't she have a right to respond contemporaneously to those complaints in writing?
There's no indication in the record that she had that right. I mean, I'm sure Home Depot will say that she did, but if you look at the actual notice, there's no place for employee comments.
Wouldn't it be sensible, though, for an employee who had some reason to think that it or who knew it wasn't true to make a written response?
I mean, it depends on if Home Depot said that's what they're allowed to do. But she did complain to Human Resources when she realized that these notices were not legitimate, you know, efforts to try to improve her store management, but they were targets. She had become a target for termination, and she realized that, and she complained to Human Resources, which was what she thought she was, you know, which was the proper procedure. But the other thing I want to say about this is I think this is important. As you consider whether the summary judgment was appropriate. If the court really just looked at those allegations made against Ms. Cotswa, you'll see that those are the type of allegations that a district manager can come in and make against any store manager. I mean, they're, you know, a lot of them are subjective in nature. You're not meeting our standards. You know, your customer service is not there. I mean, that's the type of stuff if a person wants to decide they want to, that this employee is too old, we're paying her too much, that they can always come in and make these type of allegations against a store manager, there's basically nothing she can do. and particularly when it's such a short time period. I mean, it's all of a sudden, within 5 months, she went from a valued employee to one that needs to be terminated, although she had worked there for more than 2 years. And the person who made the decision that she needed to be terminated had been there less than 2 years himself.
Well, the complaints that the store relied on were not subjective or vague. I mean, it was things like failure to maintain stock and merchandise, failure to get the merchandise down, the pack down so the customers could get to it, failure to complete calls. I mean, there's nothing vague or subjective about that.
Well, Your Honor, out of five, there's five discipline notices, and all those discipline notices are a page long. And the court has rightly pointed to a few of them that you could consider objective. But if you really went through there sentence by sentence, you'll see that most of the allegations against her are subjective in nature. And then you have to consider that evidence, what the objective evidence that Home Depot has of store management. And see, one of the things that's confused the plaintiff from the very beginning of this litigation is Home Depot goes through this long and complicated process of scoring basically each store's performance. They take in, you know, they score how many sales they should make in almost each department, what their expenses should be in each department, what their, you know, loss prevention should be in each department, and they give them up to the week, they measure them up to the week how they're performing. And they're told to do that without being a complicated and expensive process. And if you look at those objective numbers, objective performance, then she was performing satisfactory. There's no doubt about it. And so you weigh the subjective, what I would submit are mostly subjective allegations about her poor employment performance with the objective evidence of how she employed, according to the U.S. retail scorecard that Home Depot created. I think if you compare that, that further shows that the legitimate non-discriminatory reason that they suggest as the basis for her termination is just a pretext for discrimination. It doesn't match up. Their rhetoric about how bad of a store manager she was doesn't match up with the objective retail scorecard numbers.
Well, but regardless of whether she's actually bad or not, they can terminate her as long as they don't terminate her for a discriminatory reason. And you said that earlier that there was abundant evidence that she was terminated for discriminatory reasons. And I need you to refer me to that because the other side's brief says there's no evidence that she was terminated for discriminatory. So there's a large gap between no and abundant. And so can you help me? Maybe there's some evidence somewhere in the between no and abundant. I want you to go specifically by gender and then age, because I believe that the comment was an age-related comment by someone. So can you tell me what the gender discrimination, maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's a gender comment, but can you please tell me what the evidence is to support gender discrimination in the record?
Well, one, she was the only female store manager in the district at the time. In fact, she's the only female store manager during the district during the time of her employment. That's noteworthy. Two, she was the oldest, if not the oldest. I think she may have been the second oldest, either the oldest or the second oldest store manager in the district at the time. So that's noteworthy. And in fact, the Supreme Court said that's noteworthy enough that it fits. It creates a prima facie case of discrimination in itself for both age and gender. She was replaced by a younger male employee store manager.
Do you have any evidence in the record that people who did the things that you admit that she did, that she admits that she did, that were of the opposite gender or not in the age-protected class, that they were not terminated for the same kinds of actions? Is there any evidence of that in this record?
Well, Your Honor, that's a difficult question to answer because, one, that would require the person with the discriminatory motive, we believe, Mr. Murray, to have written these type of complaints against
really
other
not
people.
That's really not a difficult question. The question is there anything in the record that younger male employees were not terminated when they had similar violations? Is there anything in the record that shows that?
No, Your Honor, but I think that you have to consider that in the context of that would require the person who wanted to terminate the only female store manager and the oldest store manager to make complaints against the younger male store managers and not terminate him. Well, we believe he wouldn't do that because he didn't want them to be terminated. So the person who decides whether to make these complaints or not is the person with the discriminatory motive. So it's no surprise that he wouldn't have these type of complaints against younger male store managers. There's no surprise that he wouldn't do that. He didn't want to terminate them. He wanted to terminate Ms. Cosswell. And in fact, legally, we're not required to show that. We're not trying to – we don't have to prove that a younger male employee was treated differently than her. All we have to show is that, in fact, in the light most favorable to Ms. Cotswa, not trying to weigh the credibility of the evidence, but looking at the fact in the light most favorable to her, whether a jury should determine whether she was a victim of age or gender discrimination or whether the courts get to determine it. And I think once you view the evidence in the light most favorable to Ms. Cotswa, it's a jury question. That's all we submit. And of course,
Counsel, the reason
I'm asking about this is the kind of evidence that we routinely see that perhaps survives summary judgment. And so, other than the fact that she was the only female and she was the oldest, what other evidence supports that she was discriminated in the record?
I'm sorry, you tell it off the end. I didn't hear the end of that question. I'm sorry,
Your Honor. What other evidence, besides you said that she's the only female and she was the oldest, supports your claim for discrimination in this record?
Your Honor, you would also have to look at the testimony of her assistant store manager, Allison Barlow, about the treatment of that Scott Murray, the person we submit was the discriminatory actor, how he treated Ms. Cotswell. That's also evidence of discrimination. Now, of course, Home Depot...
That the manager discriminated because she was older or a female. Does the friend say that?
Well, she doesn't use those words, Your Honor, but she says that he treated the female older store managers differently. But she doesn't use those exact words. But again, it sounds as if the court is saying that for a Title VII plaintiff to survive summary judgment, they've got to have a smoking gun type evidence of discrimination.
No, and sir, the court is not saying that. In fact, we have written to the opposing that circumstantial evidence can be sufficient in certain circumstances. The court is just asking you what your evidence is.
I apologize, Your Honor, because I would say that some of my evidence is circumstantial. I mean, I think, you know, for example, this is, I think, a good example. If I work for a big law firm and I made the scheduling staff fool that I made in not coming to the Fifth Circuit oral argument on Monday, that's a pretty big mistake. I'm probably going to get fired. And there's going to be no reason I can claim that was some discriminatory reason behind that. But if you look at the type of mistake they're saying Ms. Cotswell made, most of them are subjective. And it's the type of mistake that any district manager can come in any store and start picking on the store manager and saying, well, this is wrong, you're out of stock here, you're in the back of the store smoking a cigarette. They can't point to a mistake she made that would just be, you know, significant enough that you would think that you would terminate an employee after 10 years.
Mr. Colum, your time is up. You've got some time left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Ms. Kogus.
May it please the court, I'd like to begin by answering Judge Elrod's questions about any evidence in the record of comments of a gender or age nature. Plaintiff testified and denied that Scott Murray ever made any such comments based on age or gender. That's record page 465. She also testified that he never raised his voice at her or called her any names, record page 890. So there is absolutely no evidence in the record of direct discriminatory comments of that nature.
You know, there seemed to be a little conflict in the brief about how well the store did under her managership.
Yes, Your Honor.
Tell me about that.
Sure. One of the ways that plaintiff attempted to establish pretext after struggling with being able to counter what was in the performance deficiency notices due to some of her admissions, as Your Honor pointed out, was that opposing counsel offered the U.S. retail scorecard. What this is a document produced by Home Depot Corporate that sets forth the sales plan for each store in a district and then keeps the scorecard, keeps track of how well the store has done as opposed to the plan. It's produced every week, and it lists the 9 stores in the district where plaintiff's Picayune store was. The scorecard that's been referred to in the record at record document 1553 was for the year-to-date week 49 of year 2011.
Just 1 week?
It was just 1 week that was offered. So point one about the scorecards is that they fluctuate. Things change with the financial numbers. Point two, if you take a look at that actual scorecard, Picayune was 7th out of 9th in performance of sales versus plan. That's hardly a ringing endorsement of how well she was performing if you look at that scorecard. Number three, we have Scott Murray's sworn deposition testimony that looking at these numbers in a vacuum does nothing. These numbers do not take into account things such as what stores have competition. For instance, plaintiff admitted the Picayune store had no competition nearby, record page 444. Other stores in the district, Hattiesburg, some of the bigger towns, had a directly competing Lowe's right down the street from Home Depot. So these things certainly affect financial performance numbers. And finally, if you look at what the standard of pretext is here, it's not simply whether the plaintiff can show some underlying nitpicks of her performance were false. Plaintiff has to show whether the decision maker's perception of her performance, whether accurate or not, was the real reason for her termination. We offer she simply cannot do that. One piece that points to that is plaintiff testified, record page 455, that after the district business walk in November of 2011, when Scott Murray discovered that her store had ordered roofing shingles when there was a verbal and a written documentation saying not to do that. She testified that she called the regional HR manager, Pam Holland, directly after that because, quote, she could tell he was very irritated with her. This is irritation relating to a specific performance issue. So it's hard for her to challenge whether Scott was truly motivated by her performance deficiencies when she herself could sense the irritation.
So you don't rely on the fact that the store's revenue went down during the time she was manager as evidence of bad performance?
We do not. That was pointed out in an early performance documentation that the sales numbers weren't quite to par. But Home Depot doesn't rely on that because we understand that there can be fluctuations. For instance, if a hurricane came, a store manager could literally sit in his office and play computer games and his store sales would be through the roof. It's the nature of the business. But what we look at is how, and that's why district managers do district business walks. They want to see if the manager's engaged. They want to see if the proper stock is on the shelf. My opponent in other proceedings has called our performance deficiency notices based on vague or minor infractions. I will tell you to Home Depot, not having an aisle of bathtubs ready to be on sale is not a minor infraction. That's what the business is. You need stock on the shelf to sell.
You didn't put any figures in for the entire time. In other words, performance figures for the store.
We didn't, Your Honor. We only relied on what was specifically detailed in the performance deficiency, but we're not contending at all that the reason for her termination had anything to do with financial numbers.
But wasn't she also criticized by Desi Broussard, who's a female manager?
That's exactly right. She was criticized by Desi Broussard, and she admitted in her deposition that Desi had spoken with her about the in-stock process, about not having things on the shelf when she needed to. In addition, her own witness, Allison Barlow, testified that the district specialty manager, a woman by the name of Laura Spell, in record page 1469, that Laura Spell was critical of the store as well, of the specialty department's performance.
And her relied on that as well.
That's right, and that Allison Barlow thought that her opinion may have tainted Scott Murray's opinion of the performance because she knew Laura Spell wasn't happy with the store either. So we're not merely relying on the testimony of the alleged discriminator. We have the testimony of Desiree Broussard, where she went in detail into the problems plaintiff was having in the store, specifically pointing out that at one time she had to go for a three-week period to order stock for plaintiff's store because plaintiff and then the department supervisors under plaintiff simply hadn't done it. So Desiree got in there and did it herself. It's hard to contradict that Home Depot was motivated by the perception of poor performance when we have this many allegations, some of which are admitted by
plaintiff. Well, and as far as her 10-year record, I mean, wasn't much of that not as Picayune manager, but rather as first an employee and then manager of a smaller store or pop-up or whatever. I mean, so in other words, it's not like she was 10 years manager of this store and then...
Exactly right. She became manager of Picayune in January of 2010.
Right before Murray came on.
The record reflects Murray came on in June of 2010. And so the initial performance eval in March of 2011 was somewhat encouraging. He pointed out the things she was doing well, the areas the store was doing well. He did also point out that she would need to make some immediate improvements in certain areas. But it wasn't right off the bat him picking on her for certain minor, as my opponent calls it, details.
What is the record about whether or not other people or person has said that he treated women who were older, or that the store as a whole has a culture to treat older women?
The offered evidence of alleged disparate treatment in the record comes from, number one, plaintiff. When I asked her, how do you contend he treated you differently from males or younger employees, she said two things. Number one, she said that in a manager's meeting, store manager meeting in October 2011, that Scott Murray was having friendly conversations with the male store managers and that he did not acknowledge her. That was the one piece. Number two, she testified that for a two-month period, he walked her store, meaning doing walking checks, once a week, and she didn't believe he did that to other male managers.
She had applied for Biloxi at that point.
That's exactly right, and that was during a time period where he was considering her for a transfer and was monitoring her performance. That's plaintiff's only testimony about alleged disparate treatment.
Co-worker.
Allison Barlow was plaintiff's direct subordinate. She's also the one who was staying in plaintiff's apartment on occasion when needed. She testified simply that she felt that Scott Murray treated them in a harsh and condescending manner, them meaning Allison Barlow and plaintiff. She admitted that she never witnessed Scott Murray's performance evaluations of plaintiffs. She was not in a position to review any performance critiques of plaintiffs
because they are older women.
She did not.
She never said the link between, she just said they were treated poorly, relatively, but it doesn't say because of this factor.
That's exactly right. And in fact, when she was asked, why do you think he terminated plaintiff? I don't know. Do you think she was a target for termination? The answer was, that's possible. So there was never any direct link. He targeted plaintiff because, in my opinion, because she was older, because she was a female. There's simply evidence that Scott Murray may not have liked them, and that's not illegal.
So what if the court were to just allege hypothetically, assume arguendo, that the court were to say, though, that some of the evidence of pretext, there were fact issues on some of the particular things, what would you say that was the way that the court should resolve this case?
Well, I think the court can simply follow the law like the district court did, in that the court is not in a position to weigh the evidence or determine credibility, and we do not dispute that. But what the court is in a position to do is discount evidence that it finds not to be competent summary judgment evidence. The courts have held that conclusory allegations or unsupported assertions are not competent summary judgment evidence, and those such things can be ignored. And specifically what I'm referring to is plaintiff's rote denials of certain parts of the performance deficiencies. In each performance deficiency, she admits...
What if we were inclined to spotter those and say those as to those deficiencies, it's murky. Can you still win?
We can. Finding those in the light most favorable to the plaintiff and saying, okay, she didn't have the bathtub but maybe she did have a certain sign up. She still cannot disprove that the motivation for her termination was Scott's perception that she was not performing well. That's what's at issue here. Not the court's not in a position to determine whether she ordered shingles improperly. The court's in a position to determine whether his perception of her performance was the true reason for her termination.
Do we have to rule on the pretext issue for you to win in your favor? Or could we rule on the no evidence of discrimination point?
I believe the court would have to consider and rule in our favor on pretext.
Tell me why.
The way the law is currently, I believe that if a plaintiff meets the prima facie case, then there is an inference.
You concede that the plaintiff meets the prima facie case here?
There is the fourth element of the prima facie case. Some courts hold that it's the plaintiff must show that similarly situated individuals were treated more favorably under nearly identical circumstances. There's also a parallel line that says it's either that or she was replaced by someone outside of the protected class. If this court uses the fourth prong in those cases, she meets her prima facie case because she was replaced by a younger male.
You're saying we have cases that do it both ways?
We do. We have cited in our briefs cases that require the similarly situated prong. If the court reviews the prima facie case using that prong, she does not meet it. They have admitted they have no evidence that other male employees were treated more favorably under nearly identical circumstances.
So the reason you can't answer what would seem like a simple question as to whether you take a position on whether she meets the prima facie case is because you believe we've confused the law in the area in this circuit. Is that, and so you don't know which line you have to rely on.
There are competing opinions in that regard. But even if she meets the prima facie case, she still hasn't shown that the proffered reason was false, and that.
Let me ask you this: on the write-ups that she got, does Home Depot allow a response to those write-ups, or are they advised that they can respond in writing?
Yes, Your Honor. There's actually a second page to the write-ups where the plaintiff can write a complaint. Unfortunately, those do not appear in the record. We had only attached the first page of the write-up containing the documentation.
Did she respond to any of them?
She never responded to any of them. And in fact, she testified that she acknowledged that at the bottom of each write-up, Scott Murray said, "The district team is always here to help you. You can contact Desi Broussard. You can contact Laura Spell." I asked her, "Did you do that?" And she responded, "No, because I didn't agree with the things he said to me, so I didn't need their help on those items." That was her testimony in the record, and that's cited. So,
did she simultaneously say, "No, this is not true" to him? Or did she just sit there and accept the review and remain quiet? What's the record say?
The record says that on specific things that she then admitted in her deposition she did, that she agreed and said, there was always an excuse. It was, I did have this special sign up, but then another team came in, the merchandising team came in and moved it, but no, I didn't follow up to make sure it got back up.
Right, but is there one that she said, no, you're absolutely wrong on this, in a polite way that you would say to your boss?
That's not developed in the record. What she says in the record is she then felt like she was being targeted, so she called HR. And she complained to HR, and HR told her, you need to talk to him directly about what's going on in your store.
Is there any written interchange between her and HR?
Not a written interchange. What we have in writing from HR is the documentation supporting Scott Murray's request for approval for termination. That's in the record, page 503 to 511.
Did he have the right to do that, or did other people have to participate?
Other people had to participate. And so in that light, he had Desiree Broussard and the two HR females, Pamela Holland and Rayon McCarthy, write inserts to his request stating what their perception of the performance was. That document then went to Pamela Holland, who then had to submit it to an executive vice president, Mr. Wilkinson, for approval. So we didn't, you know, we didn't argue that all of these other people participated because we knew we'd be met with a cat's paw argument. But it wasn't just Scott Murray participating in this decision. He needed approval. He needed to submit documentation. He didn't have the power to do it on his own.
Is our disparate precedent in both the Title VII gender and in the age discrimination on the prima facie case? Do we have cases that say the standard differently on in both areas of the law?
I believe so, Your Honor. I'm specifically picturing in my head the age discrimination because I know there's quite a bit of case law on whether the replacement needs to be outside of the protected class or just younger, even though within the protected class. So I know that that's a difference in that prima facie case. In gender discrimination, I've seen it both ways, and in fact, I've seen more frequently the similarly situated standard. And while I'm on that point, let me point to the record in that plaintiff admits she knew that there was a male manager in her district who Scott Murray started counseling almost immediately by the name of Mike Messina. He was terminated before plaintiff was. So there's no evidence in gender that he was treating any male store managers with performance difficulties any more favorably.
Does the record get specific on what his performance difficulties were?
Not that
he also smoked in the uniform or did whatever these things are?
Not specific, and the performance notices weren't entered into the record, but it was clarified that it was a history of not performing, but not to the specific infractions. There's also evidence in the record that hasn't been refuted that in a prior district, Scott Murray terminated four people, all men, three out of the four were under the age of 40. So there's simply nothing in the record that plaintiff can point to show evidence of that the proffered reason was false or that there's some overwhelming disparate treatment evidence that the court can still find pretext. And with that, I'll rest. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Colom, you got 5 minutes.
Thank you. I'll try to get to a couple points quickly. On the prima facie case issue, I would just state that the district court judge applied the replaced by a younger employee, and that on appeal, Home Depot conceded that point. So we never argued it. So we don't concede that we can't make the other standard. We just never had an opportunity to argue it. The other issue about the U.S. retail scorecards, I want to clarify something. If you look at week 49, that includes the performance for that whole year. So instead of having it for every week, we just included the scorecard for week 49. That shows the performance for the entire year. And the other issue of her being 7 out of 9, she was 7 out of 9 on one particular category, right? On the other categories about sales, some of the categories that Mr. Murray claimed that she was performing very poorly at, she performed above plan. And even her 7 out of 9, that doesn't mean that she was – what that basically means was she did better than the objective measurements for her store, but she just didn't do as much better as six other stores in this particular part, this particular category. So and this other idea that Home Depot would go through all this effort to measure each store individually and that would not be reliable, to me, a jury could look at that and say, well, that's just something that Scott Murray is trying to say because he wants to cover up the fact that objectively her store was performing well. It was performing to Home Depot's expectations. So that would be my response to that. And then on this Desi Bazaar issue, I think this is an important issue because if you actually look at the record, there's no evidence that Desi Bazaar had any problem with Debbie Coswell's management of that store until Scott Murray decided to terminate her. Desi said that she did these district business walks where she emailed Ms. Kotswa about her performance of the store. Well, we looked through those district business walks, and it's in the record, and there's no evidence, zero evidence, that Desi Bazaar had any complaints about Debbie's performance at that store. So if you actually look at it contemporaneously, when Desi was actually walking the store, there's no evidence in the record that she had any problems with the management of the store. Although, during that same period of time in her deposition, she's saying that she's having all these problems. but there's no documentation of it. And then if you look at, and then there's a question of dispute about who even wrote that part of the termination notice, whether it was Desi or whether it was Scott Murray, it's not even clear. So there's some credibility issues with Debbie's testimony. And if you look at that in the light most favorable to Ms. Cotswa, again, it supports that the reason Home Depot submitted for her termination is not worthy of credence. The question is not, for summary judgment purposes, what the law requires the plaintiff to prove is that the reason Home Depot said they terminated Ms. Cotswa is not worthy of credence. If a reasonable jury could look at our evidence in the light most favorable to us and come to that conclusion, then we survive summary judgment. It's a fact question. And this idea that it's the perception of Home Depot is what matters. Well, if that were true, then any employer can get away with unlawful discrimination because they can always say, well, our perception was that it was these reasons, these legitimate reasons. That's our perception. You can't argue somebody's perception.
Right, but you can't dispute somebody's perception. Don't we have binding case law that says it's what they thought, not what was actually true? We're bound by that. It may actually, you may be correct that makes it really hard to prove an employment discrimination case, but don't we have to follow our binding precedent that says it's not what was actually accurate, but it's what the employer perceived at the time?
I'm aware of that language, but I think you have to put it in the context of what's required for a plaintiff to survive summary judgment. Again, what's required is up for the plaintiff to show that the reason submitted by the employer for the termination is unworthy of credence. And if we can put forth, as we have in this case, objective evidence that Ms. Cotswa was not a poor store manager, objective evidence of that, and we've got evidence from we got Ms. Cotswa disputing the vast majority of the complaints against her. We've got another employee saying that that Mr. Murray belittled the employee, the female store managers, and the older store manager, Ms. Cotswa and Ms. Barlow in particular. If you got that evidence and the fact that if you look at the complaints, they're vague and subjective for the most part, and they're the type of complaints any employer could come up with to hide unlawful discrimination. And it'd be impossible, other than Ms. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Thank you so much. I appreciate the accommodation on the oral argument, Your Honors, and I apologize.
Well, you know, we've all practiced law, and we know about all the scheduling the lawyers have, but we hope we don't have a repeat of this because you won't get off this easy the next time.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I hope so. I'll do my best to make sure it never happens again.
All right. We've got your case, and that completes the docket for the morning, and we'll be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.